There's been a lot of talk today about the rule of law and national security. Where do citizens' rights start? Where does government come in? You know, sometimes we can't wait for stuff like that to happen. Sometimes we've got to organize from the grassroots up in order to make our lives tolerable, not to mention overcoming major problems when they happen and overcoming major catastrophes. That's a skill. It's a skill to turn unearned suffering and make it redemptive. I didn't say that. A great man named Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. said that. And he built an organization that showed all people everywhere how to turn unearned suffering and make it redemptive. How to stand up for yourself in any situation against any walls of oppression and resistance, overcoming any problem, human or natural. This was an organization that understood not only Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence, but understood when Gandhi said that, yes, we are a society of laws and not of men, but when bad men make bad laws and unprincipled officials compromise good ones, then it is time to stand up and be a man and exercise responsible agitation to stop governments from staggering drunkenly from wrong to wrong merely to perpetuate their own immortality. And those are words to live by, not only in the face of nullification and interposition from ruling power, but in the face of nature's fate and the cards that that deals all people. And the organization that he built, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, is perhaps preeminent in the world in empowering individuals and teaching communities from the ground up how to make a difference for themselves and their own lives by taking responsibility. And we're very proud to have with us tonight Charles Steele, Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and on a particularly important day, the day after the first anniversary of Katrina. Charles Steele, Jr., thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Before we get into the work, the glorious history of the work that the SCLC has done in civil rights and is now doing in conflict resolution, we got to know each other last year during Katrina, and I'm interested to know, the SCLC had a great project, the Delta Relief Project, that was so important to many of the victims in Mississippi and Louisiana. How is it that faith-based organizations and faith-based communities managed to overcome national bureaucratic structures that just were not responding?
Well, first of all, let me just go back to pre-Katrina and say all that you just mentioned. Basically, it's systemic. It's within the system itself. We visited Mayor Nagin, and I was with him yesterday in New Orleans. We visited him right at a year prior to the hurricane coming into the Gulf Coast, and particularly to New Orleans. What we mentioned to the mayor and others at that particular time, it's the fact that he had a discriminatory system in place right there in New Orleans in terms of racial discrimination. And the mayor was not aware of it, nor was others that was involved, basically from day to day in terms of their leadership. And what we provided for them was an incident that took place where two bodyguards, a security person at a particular club, actually killed a black student from Georgia Southern during the Christmas holidays, Christmas before last. And we told the mayor that not only was that murder in that particular case, that you had racial discriminatory practices in terms of doing business in New Orleans and on the tourist strip, and particularly on Bourbon Street. And the mayor took us at our word and said he was going to actually put out an investigation and use an undercover research team to go into the business district of New Orleans and see what he could come up with.
And Charles, if I can ask you to hold a thought, we got to take a break here. We'll be right back with Charles Steele, Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And we're talking with Charles Steele, Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, on empowerment, on why the SCLC and And faith-based communities made such a difference during Katrina. Charles Steele, you were telling us about the race problems in New Orleans when you were talking to Mayor Nagin at the time when all this occurred.
Quick. I'm going to make it quick.
You don't have to make it quick.
Okay, thank you so much. But I had to set the tone and the picture in terms of where I'm going.
Right.
Let me just say this. In all said, in terms of the charges that was brought about in terms of the racism that exists in New Orleans, Mayor Nagin sent out an undercover team and investigated and came back and actually found that the charges that we brought to fruition were true. And it came out headline of the paper that New Orleans actually had two separate prices in terms of Bourbon Street. One was a black price, one was a white price, where black people actually paid more for their lunch, their dinner, their drink, holistically throughout the city of New Orleans in terms of the discriminatory practices that we discovered.
It's amazing we're still looking at things like that in 2006.
That's right.
And particularly in a city with, I don't know how the population breaks down, but the black population has got to be the plurality.
That's most definite. Black people there are in the majority. I can actually say probably anywhere from 72 to 75%.
And Mayor Nagin, who himself is black, wasn't aware of any of this?
He was not aware of this. But I give him credit that the fact that he came out and actually admitted that it was a serious problem after we brought it to his attention. And many times, you know, we have our agenda in terms of being successful and taking on our responsibilities as leaders and things like this. And sometimes we can become insensitive to the grassroots effort of day-to-day oppression of people. But I have to give Mayor Nagin credit. He came out and supported the fact that we brought to his attention. And I said all that to say this, is that we still have a serious problem within this country and throughout the world, but particularly during the pre-Katrina as well as currently after or post-Katrina, we still have serious problems in terms of the people still not being given their due process of being made whole.
Let me say something. I don't mean for this to be to get in the way of the human tragedy that everybody suffered, black
right.
and white, and everybody. But there was criticism early on. There was talk, and your point about New Orleans as a city, the racial makeup of it is just on this point. There was talk that if this wasn't New Orleans, that if it had been a city with a larger white population, a lot of other measures would have been taken earlier on. Do you feel any sense of that?
Most definite.
Was this a case of sort of benign neglect?
Yes. It was, and it was intentional due to the fact that it was racial. First of all, I was with City Council Lady Cynthia Willard Lewis, who represents the Ninth Ward, and I like what she says. She said, "I'm from the Nine, and you're not going to take mine." What she means about that is that we feel very strongly that it's more to it than just wanted to discriminate against poor folks and people of African descent. What we actually feel from the groundswell of information that we have received is that it's all about the money. It's all about the dollar. It's always been a potential there that New Orleans, and particularly in the Ninth Ward, underneath the surface is oil. It's all about oil again. Many persons that I've talked to, and I'm not saying that this is factual, but I'm saying what the perception is from poor folks and people of the Ninth Ward is that it's about the richness again, and it's a war between the haves and the have-nots, and it's about people wanting to turn New Orleans into a Las Vegas. It's all about the entrepreneurship of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poor.
There was some question at the time of Katrina asked when Mayor Nagin ordered the evacuation of the city. There was a lot of talk about, well, why didn't he use the school buses that were still sitting parked to get the poor folks out who didn't have cars to go?
That's correct. And it was poor planning. And I think traditionally the people say it as well as the leadership, we have survived many hurricanes, and this is just another hurricane. But the fact being that no one gave any attention to poor folks. Poor people, and I didn't say poor people.
But it wasn't just the municipal bureaucracy. It was also the state and federal.
It was holistically throughout the bureaucracy.
Nobody wanted to bother anybody on top of them.
Most definitely. Most definitely. So where do we go from here? We're going to stay on the battleground. We're going to stay in New Orleans. We will probably go to jail next week because on September the 6th, the school board is still going ahead with the plan to actually let the students at Martin Luther King Elementary School be enrolled into a dilapidated schoolhouse building where you have more rats than students. And we're saying before we let that happen, we'll stand in front of the door and won't let anyone in, and the city will have to take us to jail. Reverend Al Sharpton also said that he would go to jail with us.
Charles Steele, please, I want to talk to you more about this right after this short break. Or email us with any questions for any guests. If you can't call in at info@iapm.ca, and we're privileged to have with us Charles Steele, Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And we're talking about the work the SCLC did during Katrina, how perhaps benign neglect due to latent racism was at the cause of a lot of that, and what the SCLC today is doing still to combat things. And Charles, we know you and I met Reverend Darrell Gray, and he's done a tremendous amount of work even up here in Montreal in terms of raising the consciousness of Montrealers to the latent problems that simmer just beneath the surface in a society that everybody thinks has got everything together, but sometimes it's not so together, is it?
That's correct. We still have the same problems that we've incurred and been prolonged in terms of discriminatory practices within society for many of years. Nothing has changed, but everything has changed in terms of the approach. You know, we have even people of African descent in places that we never had before, but this tokenism, and we still have some black faces in white places, which doesn't give us the totality of freedom. We must fight for freedom on a daily basis, not just on Dr. King's birthday, not just during Black History Month, but every day.
Every day.
And everyone of the fair-mindedness of being God-fearing and Christians and religious organizations of all ethnicity and background must work on this holistically and harmoniously on a daily basis and not just certain aspects of celebration.
Dr. King had always taught that social justice and political justice and economic justice went hand in hand and had to be fought for together. But have the gains that have been made over the past 30 years, particularly in social and political justice, is the battlefield now on economic justice?
It's both. It was during the transatlantic African slave trade, while we were sold into slavery from the continent of Africa, was about economics. And it's still about economics today. And it's a war. It's a war between the haves and the have-nots. But the system worldwide have a tendency to understand that people can be sold out and bought out in terms of the lack of respect of the heritage from which we all come from. Regardless of the ethnicity or of racial makeup of any individual, we should all be motivated to do the right thing. It's always right to do right. And that's what we must win on a daily basis in terms of people participating in the dream and the implementation of the dream in terms of Dr. King and many others who died for our freedom.
You have a renewed agenda under the motto or the title, if you like, A New Day and a New Way, and it reminded me of an old story of three holy men who were sitting around trying to decide when day began by trying to figure out where the stars are in the heavens. And after 36 hours of this, one of the holy men stood up and said, "Gentlemen, after all this talk, I still don't know when day begins, but I know, he said, that when we can no longer tell a white man from a black man or a rich man from a poor man and treat a woman no differently than we treat ourselves, then I know a new day has begun." Are we any closer to that?
Well, again, we must work on it every day. And I think we arrested...
Eyes on the prize.
Eyes on the prize, always. And I think we have rested on our laurels in terms of the fact that we come a long ways, but we have a long way to go. And by achieving some of our goals and objectives, we think that we have arrived. But I tell people, if you think you have arrived, you need to get back on the train because you got off at the wrong station. We are not there yet. We won't get there until we all realize that all aspects of human life is important.
Charles Steele Jr., all aspects of human life are important, and with men like you around to keep reminding us of that, we'll all get there together. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Take care. Montreal will be right back. This half hour, we're going to take a little departure. We're not going to look at the news. You know, so often we concentrate on what's in the newspapers, and you know what? Most of the time, most of what we're reading is mostly wrong. It gives many of us a feeling of hopelessness and despair, and we can't get out of our preconceived notions, predefined positions. We compromise hope sometimes. And this half hour, I want to talk to a remarkable group of people that centers around the efforts that have been brought together in great part in our world by one man, Charles Sheridan Coffey. Charles Coffey is not just a friend, and I'll say it off the top, but he's Executive Vice President for Government Relations and Public Affairs of the Royal Bank of Canada. So you might say, so what? Well, the so what is this, that despite what Charlie Coffey, as he insists on being called, likes to refer to himself as just a little New Brunswick banker, this man's taken this position and built bridges that are singularly unique in this country. Here's a banker who's built bridges to organized labor. Here's a banker who's involved in human rights. Here's a banker who's involved with poor kids and sick kids and street kids, creating halfway houses and all kinds of things that address the social ills that plague urban life. And we're very proud and honored tonight to have Charlie Coffey with us, whose retirement has been announced today. It's not effective today, but from Toronto. Charlie Coffey, welcome, friend.
Good evening, brother. Good evening, Beryl.
And with us is also Buzz Hargrove, President of the Canadian Auto Workers. Welcome, Buzz.
Thank you very much.
And from Winnipeg, Gail Asper, Managing Director of the Asper Foundation and the engine behind the Canadian Human Rights Museum that we hope will start being built very shortly. Gail, thanks for taking the time.
Good evening, Beryl. It's an absolute pleasure.
Charlie Coffey, so what was wrong with being, and you know, you're speaking now not to me, you're not even speaking to most of the audience, you're speaking to young people, you're speaking to those kids that you give talks to, and I give talks to, and Buzz gives talks to, and Gail gives talks to, who are sitting at universities and going, I'm going to get the big bucks, and I don't care about anything else, I'm just going into corporate life, and the hell with everything else. Charlie Coffey, why did you decide to do all these things with your life, instead of just sitting down, raking in the dough, and taking it easy? What's the message out there?
Well, Buzz, just a little background. Like Buzz Hargrove, I grew up in the upper St. John River Valley of New Brunswick. I was the seventh of nine kids in a very strong Irish Catholic family. And my mother instilled in me at a very early age a very strong sense of social justice that's lasted with me to this day. So, yes, I know how to enhance shareholder value and increase productivity and all those sorts of things that corporate executives are expected to do. But at the end of the day, we cannot forget what makes this country great. Neighborhoods, communities, people from all walks of life. And you mentioned organized labor off the top, and I acknowledge that Buzz Hargrove and I are great friends.
And boy, did it get the chattering class going in Toronto when you and him wrote an op-ed.
No question, but we all have a place in this society is the point.
We tend to categorize ourselves and stigmatize ourselves with labels. I just want to ask Gail, because I know Gail has a previous commitment. Gail Asper, Charlie Coffey is the chair of the Advisory Council to the Canadian Human Rights Museum that the Asper Foundation has been behind, that was your late father's dream. You couldn't have picked a better guy. How did the two of you meet?
Well, I knew Charlie when he was the head of the bank here in Winnipeg. And by the way, routinely people come up and say, boy, you know, in the business world, if it hadn't been for Charlie Coffey launching and believing in my business, I would be nowhere. And these are very successful business people. So he has an instinct for projects and people that really are going to make a difference. So, but on the museum project, Charlie sent me an email one day saying, listen, this is the greatest project I've seen in a long time. Let me know what I can do. And he's not the sort of guy that just says, let me know what I can do, and then you never hear from him again.
Right.
You call him, and he leaps into action immediately. And we hear this time and time again about whatever project Charlie's working on. Heart and soul, intelligence and compassion. They just don't make him like Charlie.
Buzz Hargrove, I said when you and Charlie wrote an op-ed some months back, if the chattering classes in Toronto got going, So here are three people, you know, labor on one side, the Asper Foundation on the other side, but CanWest Global, pretty big outfit, Charlie Coffey, the Royal Bank. How did this come about? You've broken a lot of stereotypes in your life, but you really broke many in these relationships.
Well, by the way, I want to acknowledge the work that Gail has done, Gail Asper, on the Human Rights Museum. She's done a remarkable job, and I think Charlie will endorse that.
Absolutely.
How does this thing happen?
Thank you very much.
When I heard that Charlie was leaving the bank, I thought they fired him for sure.
Oh, nice.
They caught up with him. He's been working at the bank all of these years, promoting so many things that are not related at all to the business of the Royal Bank of Canada, that they finally caught up and fired my good friend Charlie. So I was shocked until I found out that he had made a decision to leave. There's not many like Charlie Coffey, and I too attribute it to the fact that he comes from the Upper St. John River Valley. And I've really enjoyed my relationship with him over the many years now, and his commitment to people and community and country is surpassed by no one that I've met.
Buzz, I want to come back after this.
Business, labor, or non-governmental organization, nobody has done it as well or more committed than Charlie.
Buzz, I want to come back after this short break and continue this conversation about you and Charlie. Gail, I know we have to say good night to you, and we thank you for taking the time to join us. And Montreal will be right back.
Charlie, all the best.
Thanks, Gail.
We'll be right back, Montreal. Or email us at info@iapm.ca. And for this half hour, this night, I'm not angry. We have the privilege of talking with Charlie Coffey, who will be retiring in October. It was announced today as Executive Vice President of the Royal Bank. So what you say, well, there's a lot of Executive Vice Presidents of Government Relations and Public Affairs, but few who have broken down the typical pigeonholes between corporate life, union life, human rights work, relief of suffering at the street level. And we're joined also by Buzz Hargrove. Very proud to have him here. And I know the two of you are proud to call each other friends. Now, Buzz, you were telling us before the break there was a love-in between the two of you, but forget the love-in from two New Brunswickers. It must have been quite something within the broad community generally, but even within the labor community, when here you are introducing your friend Charlie Coffey as someone that you make common cause with on issues of social justice and the labor agenda. The first time must have been quite novel for a lot of your guys.
Yes, absolutely. To people, when you make these kind of statements as a labor leader, people generally question it if you're talking about a prominent business person. But most of the people that I've been involved in and had a chance to follow Charlie Coffey, they don't question his commitment, and they don't question our friendship, and I'm quite proud of it. I got to tell you this story. I was in Vancouver at our convention, Charlie, and the convention was over, and Thursday afternoon, my partner Denise and I went out shopping for shoes for her. We went to a shoe store. There's a woman trying on a pair of shoes. Denise says, "Boy, those are beautiful shoes. They look really nice on you." And the woman said, "Oh, thank you very much," and she said, "You look like Buzz Hargrove." And I said, "Well, some people have told me that." She said, "I just exchanged an email with Charlie Coffey today about you attending a meeting with us." And I thought, I don't remember the woman's name, Charlie, or who she was with. But Charlie touches people from coast to coast to coast and internationally. That's the kind of human being he is, and he deserves a great deal of credit for the work
that he does. Charlie, yes. You and Buzz have particularly been active in children's rights, in shelters, for street kids. How did that start?
Well, I think we both understand, first of all, the importance of the development of human capital at the earliest ages of children, 0 to 5. And I've often credited the CRW for the very progressive view on child care and some of the great work Buzz and his people have done in that area. And years ago, when we began to think about the need for a national program, and perhaps child care, daycare are the wrong words to describe this whole focus on the children's agenda, the early years, and the influences that must impact children if we are to reduce cost to society later on through reduced school dropout rates, incarceration, and you know all the issues there, Beryl. So Buzz and I have that in common, the advancement of the children's agenda, and whether it's within the Royal Bank or within the CAW or elsewhere, we understand the importance of driving that agenda. having the managerial courage to stand up and speak out on these issues of importance to Canadians, whatever their ideology is. And so that brought us together in an op-ed piece in the Globe and Mail. And I can tell you when that op-ed piece hit Bay Street.
Oh, yeah. I remember the morning.
With my picture and Buzz's picture.
I remember the morning.
Charlie has this unique ability to bridge.
Post who said that they were wanted to put their kids in the Get a Buzz On with Charlie Daycare Center when it opened.
Now, you know, and this is what makes this relationship and the set power, the center of influence that you've created, Charlie, in the best way. Why I use that word influence, so unique. And we're just joined by another friend of all of us, Pat Gagnon, president of the parliamentary group. Patrick Gagnon, how are you? Well, thanks for coming on today.
Bonjour. You know, there will be a Quebec connection at some point.
Patrick, I want to ask you something. You're a former MP. You know the Ottawa scene as well as anybody in your company, the parliamentary group. You've got all kinds of ex-MPs. How come Charlie Coffey has been able to use this office? And you know that every bank, every corporation has an executive vice president, a senior executive dealing with government relations and public affairs. How come Charlie Coffey has singularly managed to craft this position so effectively, much more and much more visibly and much more effectively than almost any other?
You know what many MPs and politicians, senators, and others will say, there are usually great people in different fields that come up every generation. And I think Charlie's really one of those in the banking field. You know, we may have had views, thoughts about the banking industry, but when Charlie...
No, he only has thoughts with me about that when I question mergers. Now, but I promised I wouldn't raise Charlie's blood pressure tonight. Sorry. What did I say? Bank pressure. Blood pressure.
It's something that you have to underline, and they understand that, you know, Charlie has this ability to reach out, to listen to people, to tell them, you know, what the story is, what the issue is about, and you sort of encourage that trust, you know. And you know, Charlie, often when Charlie gives a speech, you know, people are really at attention. I don't know if he's planning a political career. I mean, that's been around. But it's, as Charlie, as you often say, it's, you know, it's not what we may have said or done, but it's how you make people feel. And I think that's one of the great qualities of Charlie Coffey with not only politicians, but also with the public at large, be it minority groups, be the dispossessed, and people that he's reached out over the years.
Charlie, Pat Gagnon has told us how you affect the outside. What I want to hear from you when we come back after this short break is how you manage to get the mandate from the inside to do what you do.
Great.
Montreal, we'll be right back after this.
Okay.
And we're talking about breaking down stereotypes tonight, and we've got a tremendous group of people with us right now. Charlie Coffey, Executive Vice President for Government Relations and Public Affairs at Royal Bank, whose October retirement has been announced today. His good friend Buzz Hargrove, President of Canadian Auto Workers, and Patrick Gagnon, President of the Parliamentary Group. Before the break, Patrick was telling us the kind of effect that Charlie had and how he used this position almost singularly uniquely in this country, but I posed the question to Charlie, which I'd now like answered. How did you get this mandate out of an institution as big as the Royal Bank, as rule-bound as the Royal Bank?
Well, Beryl, I can tell you that in my 44 years at the bank, I've had 29 different positions, but again, I have always carried with me this very strong social justice mindset instilled in me by my mother and my six sisters and two brothers and my dad. And everywhere I have gone in the bank, whether it be in Atlantic Canada, Montreal, Toronto, Winnipeg, I have looked out at the community and said, what needs to be done here? How can we advance civil society in this country? And I will tell you, as I have focused on the advancement of women entrepreneurs, Aboriginal people, focused on diversity, the children's agenda, and on and on and on, I came to the conclusion very early that what is good for Canada is good for Royal Bank. Management, that was not lost on management of RBC. When I took on this role in 1999, our then head John Claycorn and followed by Gord Nixon, both very, very supportive of my outreach activities because they get it. They understand that, again, what is good for Canada is good for our bank.
But Charlie, I've asked you this question often, one-on-one. Let's just address it. You will agree with me that it's rare in corporate life to see people get it?
Well,
has it not been your unique ability to make a lot of people get it?
No, well, Beryl, I'm one of a team within the Royal Bank, but a team in society, and that includes Patrick Gagnon, and Gail, and Buzz, and you yourself. I mean, I've learned a great deal from your email rants, if I could refer to them as those from time to time. But I listen to what people have to say. And I, on that point, in terms of listening, I will always remember what a Cree elder in northern Manitoba said to me in the early 90s. Mr. Coffey, listen or your tongue will cause you to become deaf.
Listen or your tongue will cause you to become deaf.
Right.
Buzz Hargrove, you're not known for letting your tongue become deaf. Come on, what's the real story here? How did he manage this?
No, he's a remarkable person.
He's put together this unique community of interest.
He's a New Brunswicker. That's the first
thing. That's it, eh?
His family, his mom instilled in him, much like mine did me and others that he came in touch with. And Charlie Coffey believed in social justice issues, believed in the broader community. And he, unlike some who just talk about it, he really showed it in all of the activities that he's had during his career.
Pat Gagnon, you've worked a lot with Charlie in Ottawa. How is it behind closed doors?
It's just like the man. It's just like he is. It's very natural. It's upfront. It's banking is, as I've realized, is very much a people business. It's the relationships. It's reaching out to people, and I think Charlie brought in all those qualities. And of course, with the great support of a great and extraordinary team at, you know, in probably Canada's greatest financial, you know, institution. So by bringing government and bringing people and banks together, it's been a hallmark of his tenure as Vice President of Government Relations and Business Development.
Charlie Coffey, you are not going gently into that good night. You're gonna have a hell of a mark on this country. You're continuing your work as chair of the Advisory Council of the Human Rights Museum, which hopefully the construction of which will get underway soon. Any other large projects on the horizon?
Well, I'm very concerned about what's going on in the Middle East, Beryl. I'm very concerned about that, and I'm an admitted, unabashed supporter of the State of Israel, and I think what's happening needs to be addressed in terms of more people speaking out on what is really happening, and I will be continuing the search for truth in that conflict and ensure that there is balance. I'm not happy with what's going on now, so that is of interest to me. I will pursue my interest in diversity, and ensuring that people from all walks of life who chose this country are included, whether it be Aboriginal peoples or immigrants. I believe they have a right to take their rightful place in Canadian society, and I will pursue that in retirement to the best of my ability, and continue to reach out to people from all walks of life.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for your time. And, you know, we've had a whole evening here with Charles Steele, Gail Asper, Charlie Coffey, Buzz Hargrove, Pat Gagnon, of people who've broken stereotypes, of people who, in the words of the old black spiritual, the only thing we did wrong was staying in the wilderness too long. The first thing we did right was the day we began to fight. And we've had a night of fighters and a night of people breaking stereotypes and showing everybody and the society at large how every individual, as tired as they are, as put upon as they are, can feel empowered, just reach out one to the other. Thank you all, gentlemen. Thank you, Nick Mays and Master Control. We'll be back tomorrow night.